Hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. Bienvenue to those of you who enjoyed our French presidential podcasts. Tom, we didn't do a bonus last week because we did our live stream on the subject of heroism. Did you think it was sufficiently heroic?
I very much enjoyed it. And I do like those episodes where it's possible to kind of think and kind of go down rabbit holes and follow threads and that kind of thing. But obviously, the problem with trying to deal with such a huge topic in an hour is always that you may omit certain topics. So I had a message from Robert Colville, who is the head of the Centre of Policy Studies. Centre for Policy Studies.
The sort of right of centre think tank.
Who was struck by the absence of scientific heroes.
They're not heroes.
He says, as with reputations, where you missed out on Einstein, Curie, Darwin, etc., as people who'd be remembered.
Well, there are two issues with that, I think. One issue is that I am, as some people will know, and I know they, don't lecture me about it, because you're not going to change my mind. I'm not interested in science.
Well, do you know what I replied to him?
What did you say?
A simple one. I said, Dominic hates science, I'm afraid.
So there's that. There's that issue. And by the way, as I say, on the Discord, don't give me a lot of grief. It's too late now. You know, I'm halfway through my life, at least. I'm not going to change now. So, if there's more history to be read, I'm not going to start reading a load of science instead.
We are going to do some science, aren't we?
Surely. Yeah, you had medieval science. I gave you medieval science.
And dinosaurs.
Yeah. I mean, what more do you want? We've done 200 podcasts and you've had two.
Darwin. I want Darwin.
Okay. I'm sure we can. Listen, I'm very pliable, as you know.
Yeah, you are.
But I think, actually, in answer to Robert Colville's question, the scientists don't tend to be heroes in the same way, do they? So scientists may be heroes for other scientists. But I think among the public at large, Nelson, Churchill, Alfred the Great, I don't know, Heracles, Achilles, Napoleon, they loom much larger than any scientist.
I would say that there is one scientist, or someone who is thought of as a scientist, who does kind of have that heroic stature, and that's Galileo.
Yeah, okay, but that's not because of the science, it's because of the suffering.
Which was bogus.
Oh, Tom, that's a surprise. We should do one on Galileo.
So we should do one on Galileo.
Yeah,
because there's a chapter in Dominion debunking his heroic status.
Well, I think this is that's the sort of science I like. What I don't like is science where the guy is just working in a lab and
with test tubes.
And it's just a great discovery. It's lovely. I don't like that. I'm not interested in that.
Firm views, robustly expressed.
Or how things work. I find that fundamentally boring.
Well, but isn't, I mean, quite a lot of history is about how things happen.
I like to know how the economy works or how a temple ritual might work, but I don't want to know how a piece of mechanical equipment works.
Okay. Or even the processes of evolution.
I have no time for that. No.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm okay. Guys, we will be doing Darwin and Dominic's just going to have to suck it up.
I will.
So there we go.
So Tom,
Should we get on to some questions?
Yes. Let's do the general chat first, and then we'll do the individual episodes. So this is one for you from Comeback Zinc. Who is the author with the largest surviving body of work from antiquity? I've heard it is either Galen or Augustine, but I actually don't know. There seems to be a lot of Pliny. Oh, this is
There is a lot of Pliny about.
So who's got the most stuff?
I believe it's Augustine by miles.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they sermons and letters
sermons,
to
books,
people about God?
All that kind of stuff. You don't like that either, do you?
No, it's fine. I mean, it's fine.
So much you don't like.
I'm not going to dig into it anytime soon, that's for sure. What about non-religious?
So Galen is the guy who is, I'm afraid, a medical
He's a scientist,
person.
Right?
Well, he's not a scientist, but he's verging on that.
Yeah.
He has the largest corpus of any Greek writer.
Interesting.
Do you know, okay, so here's a trick question, and it obviously won't be who you think it is. The Greek historian with the largest surviving body of work.
The Greek historian. So it's not Herodotus or Thucydides. They're too obvious. Or is it Herodotus? Because it's a trick question.
It's not Herodotus.
Is it somebody like...
It's Diodorus Siculus.
I was going to say, is it Diodorus?
Yeah.
So Diodorus wrote a huge, huge sort of chronicle, didn't he?
Yeah.
So he writes about Alexander.
Yeah. And he writes about Cleopatra, doesn't he? And Antony. He's contemporary.
So he goes all up. He does basically the last three centuries before Christ.
And the amazing thing is that we've only got about a quarter of his work.
But is he one of those people that we've got a lot of his stuff preserved and other people's subsequent stuff? Yeah. All right. Well, let's have another question. Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc.
That's very good, because it's spelled Jonahvark.
Yeah, I didn't get that until I read it out. So what era of history do you most love the idealized version of as an era to visit or live in. So obviously there's lots of terrible living conditions, but if you could live in the ideal version, the social class of your choosing, which era? That's a funny question. Tom, what would you choose?
I'm going to speak as my 10-year-old self.
Yeah.
And it would be Augustan Rome.
Yeah, I think that's...
I mean, it would be an awful time. It would be awful.
No, but you're choosing the idealized version.
But I'm choosing the idealized version.
I mean, to be a Roman aristocrat, you know, being waited on hand and foot, watching gladiatorial games, that's my idea of heaven.
I have a kind of synesthetic sense of history in childhood.
Right.
So for me, the classical world was blue skies.
Yes, of course.
And then the Dark Ages, obviously, it's kind of drizzle and...
Of course, yeah.
Leaves across...
It's never raining in Augustan Rome.
It's never rains in Augustan Rome. It's always clear blue skies, beautiful weather.
And it's never sunny togas. In Anglo-Saxon England, right?
Never. I mean, never. Well, occasionally, maybe there may be a kind of sun at, you know, sunset, but then it gets blotted out by stubborn
also,
cloud.
On a, surely on a day when it's sunny, isn't that ominous? Because it means the Danes are going to land at any moment.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
It was such a lovely
on their
day.
Helmets.
Yeah. It was such a lovely day. And he was looking forward to playing with the sheep. But then he saw shapes on the horizon.
I suppose. And in English history, the equivalent would be the Elizabethan age, where it's like Wilton House. It's like Wilton House in Blackadder.
Yeah.
Do you remember? They're kind of playing on lutes and going on boats and things, but which obviously would be wholly bogus because of the teeth and the.
But actually,
the
there's loads of idealized moments in English history, aren't there? I mean, 18th century, hanging around with Dr. Johnson, drinking port and William Pitt.
No, because that's autumnal. That's autumnal.
Oh, right.
18th century is autumnal.
Oh, well, in that case, if you're going for summers, I'm going to go for the summer of 1914. Playing cricket. You'd like that, Tom. You know, top nation.
Yeah. But you've got...
Reading Edward Thomas.
But rain is very much about to stop play.
I suppose so, yeah.
Robin Hood, I suppose.
Yeah, of course.
Under the green tree. An episode we're coming up to do.
Sun-dappled clearings.
Okay, and here is a question from Kakenet. I'm hoping now that Musk is buying Twitter, you guys will choose another platform to communicate on. Is his takeover a good or a bad thing? Well, I'm guessing that Kakenet thinks it's a bad thing. I have no strong views on it at all.
I actually don't even know how Elon Musk, as far as he's science to me. He's a man who just sort of swam into the headlines for no reason that I could discern, something to do with electric cars. And I haven't followed his career.
Well, I followed his career with some interest because he is he went out with Grimes, who is one of our top-ranked followers on Twitter.
So she's I wouldn't say she's a friend of the show, but she's an associate or an acquaintance of the show, is she?
She's an acquaintance of the show, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I think in that sense, perhaps, I don't know, are we in favour of Musk? Maybe. I mean, maybe Grimes and Musk and Grimes says, oh, listen to this. About dwarf flunking or something.
It depends on that, because they have parted ways, I think, and it depends on the terms on which they parted.
Yes, it does. It does.
Tom, there's a brilliant question from Greg Noonan, who's reading absolutely top literature.
Oh, yes, I'll read that. In the midst of Seasons in the Sun. What?
Yeah.
Who wrote that? I'm curious whether Dominic would still consider Wilson's final two-year administration the worst in modern British history. For my money, I'd say the unfortunate Ms. May's tenure probably takes the cake.
How come she's a Ms. there? She's a Mrs. She was always, I used to call her Mrs. May when I was, because Mrs. May is also the name of the headmistress in Biff, Chip and Kibber.
They've just been cancelled, haven't they?
They have. I don't want to, I'm just too depressed about that, Tom.
You know, I was happy. I hate Biff. So we should explain.
What?
Biff,
no.
Biff and Chip are the books that British children learn to read with.
Yeah.
And they are the bane of parents' lives, in my opinion.
Not in my
opinion. They've just been cancelled for being basically racist.
They weren't racist. It's a totally concocted and contrived story. They're on the run with Princess Aisha in the story The Blue Eye. And of course they're agitated in the market.
No, Dominic.
They're looking
they're
out
racist,
for enemy.
They should be cancelled and punished.
Also, Tom, as you know, because I've told you before, the Biff, Chip and Kipper stories, they escalate into the Time Chronicles, which a lot of people don't know about, but they should. Which are a very complicated series of Harry Potter-style shenanigans where it's revealed that the school caretaker is actually the Time Guardian Mortlock.
Yes, I remember you telling me. I hadn't got that far. Anyway,
yeah, but if you get
anyway
that
sorry,
far,
sorry.
It's like reading The Hobbit and not reading The Lord of the Rings. Madness. Harold Wilson. Yeah. I still think it's the worst because I think the difference is that...
So this is 1974 to
76. Because I think... Irrespective of policy decisions, we know from the diaries of insiders that they were deliberately, that Wilson was, he'd lost enthusiasm, he'd lost interest, he wasn't taking decisions.
He had early onset dementia, didn't he?
It's not, we don't know, because it's very hard to distinguish that from, he was probably drinking a bit too much and it's very hard to just to work out exactly. He definitely, you would say, you know, I don't, my memory is not what it was. I don't have answers anymore to some of these questions, blah, blah, blah. And there was a real sense of drift. And I think that's slightly different from the May administration where, I mean, I think she handled it politically very, whatever the opposite of adeptly is, very ineptly. But I think she had an impossible inheritance and it was in an incredibly difficult position. I don't think that's quite the case with Wilson in 74 to 76. I mean, it's difficult economically, but he could have done something. Anyway, listen, this is a subject of a podcast.
It is. Yes, it is.
In itself.
So here's a question from Dreadnought. And actually, I think this is one for Jack. Can anyone confirm where they got podcast theme music from? Is it an original composition? If so, what was the inspiration? Jack, are you there?
Hello.
Jack, hi.
Hi, Jack.
Welcome back onto the podcast.
It's from a production music library. It's called Expect the Unexpected. Listening to loads of different bits of music that I thought would work. The interesting thing about it is I think the guy is from the Divine Comedy, one of the composers. I get their names if you come in too soon.
Live research.
Is he on the Bodleian?
Jack is going to the Bodleian.
Composed by Andrew Skeet and Nathan Klein, and I think Andrew Skeet is in the Divine Comedy.
Oh, brilliant. Divine Comedy. Love the Divine Comedy.
Tom, had it take you like 10 minutes for that to dawn on you who the Divine Comedy were?
I didn't know the Divine Comedy were in any way responsible for that music.
I mean, Jack had told you a few minutes ago it's by a guy who was in the Divine Comedy and you just sat there staring into space.
Sorry, I was miles away then because I should explain because probably all of this has been cut out, but it actually took Jack about 5 minutes to work it out and I'm afraid I just drifted off and I didn't hear that. They're big cricket fans.
Are they?
Divine Comedy, yeah.
Irish cricket fans.
Yep.
Well, they do exist, don't they? Yep. Jack has now disappeared, and we should talk about the individual episodes that we did. So we've got...
Well, hold on.
Go on.
We've got a pie chart, which I know you don't like because it's science.
Yeah.
Or maths.
Maths, I thought we'd avoid
Sam the Burgundian Wang created a few questionnaires, and he's... if you go on a budget time trip, where would you go? And these are all episodes from our respective lives. Yeah. And Dominic, by miles, the most popular choice is some theatre in Edinburgh when Dominic started and ended his thespian career.
Well, first of all,
so that's you playing Beckett.
It wasn't the end. I was in place since then. When I was a graduate student, Tom, would you believe, I was in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I was also in a production of 12 Angry Men.
Well, so many things that a time traveler could go and see.
When we did One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I remember we came out on stage to do the production, and there was only one person in the audience, and that was my supervisor. And the rest of the cast wanted to abandon it, and I said the show must go on, so we just did it just for him. Tells you how popular we were as a company.
Okay, and number two is in some coffee bar in London where Tom steals croissant from Jack. Well, see, I'd like to see that because I don't even remember it. I think Jack's fantasizing.
No, I think it sounds so in character. But some cricket field in England with Tom when the news broke on Diana was third. And I think, Tom, that is because people want to hear Jason Cowley shouting at you.
Yes.
You're losing us the match.
You're losing us the match.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all very interesting.
Right. Jason Cowley. So he was our guest on England and the English. I think generally very warmly received with a couple of detractors who didn't like him because they don't like the New Statesman or because they don't like football or because they
woke tosh.
Yeah, woke tosh kind of people. Sam the Burgundian Wang, compiler of pie charts, says, we left the Queen and the whole institution of the monarchy out of it. Is the Queen more English or British? Tom, answer to that, I would say British, very clearly.
The monarchy sees itself as...
And I think maybe this isn't so obvious to people outside the United Kingdom, but I would say inside it, it's very obvious how much the sort of Balmoral trip to Scotland, the sort of Princess Anne dressing head to foot in tartan and applauding.
Well, she's the patron of Scottish rugby.
All of that sort of stuff. I think certainly with Scotland, the royal family try very hard. I mean, they don't always succeed in persuading, you know, the Scottish public that they are as Scottish as they are English. But they certainly try to, don't they? I don't know whether they try so hard with Wales.
Well, the Prince of Wales, he went and learnt Welsh, didn't he?
Yes, because he was in Anglesey.
And they had that kind of ludicrous made-up investiture.
For Prince Charles
in
1969?
Yeah.
Designed by Lord Snowden. I'm looking forward to another one of those.
Timeless ritual.
Well, yeah, all timeless rituals invented, aren't
but
they?
But I mean, we have talked about the monarchy. We did an entire World Cup on it, and we do have a couple of episodes coming up on Elizabeth II, don't we?
We do. Yeah, we do.
Okay.
So, next question. Do you want to do Ben Fuji's question?
Ben Fuji. It was certainly great to see the number of black faces in England's lineup for the match against Italy in the final of the Euros. But, what about the abuse of those same black footballers when they missed those penalties and the mayhem in and around the ground, even before the game had been lost? Well, on the mayhem in and around the ground, even before the game had been lost, I posted a photo of a fan sticking a firecracker up his arse.
You did?
Which I then got in trouble with because I hadn't credited the photo. I had no idea.
Do you need credit?
Apparently you do. I had no idea. So I apologize to the guy who'd taken the photo because it was a truly excellent photo.
Yeah, it was.
Summing up the John Bull spirit, Dominic.
Well, that's the point. That's the point about the mayhem.
The Lord of Misrule.
I was abroad. I was in Greece when that, for the final. And I was sort of following the mayhem, you know, on the computer or on my phone or whatever. And I just thought, especially from outside, I just thought, this is the most English thing.
It's Merry England, isn't it?
It's so 18th
century. Baiting bulls.
It's sort of the final is happening, and this colossal mob have descended on the stadium, absolutely coked up, hammered,
sticking firecrackers up their bum.
Yeah, just behaving disgracefully. And this, of course, is, as a right thinking person, sort of deplorable. But at the same time, it's so 18th century. I mean, it's so kind of London mob.
On the abuse, I wasn't clear at the time, and I'm still not clear, Dominic. Maybe you know. Mm-hmm. To what extent was the racism the point, or was it the abuse of someone who misses a penalty? Because there's potentially a kind of crossover there.
I think you're probably right. I think any England player who missed a penalty in that context would have received, with social media in operation, would have received a lot of abuse. I think that's fair to say. So in other words, when Stuart Pearce missed in 1990 or Southgate himself, the manager in 1996, they'd have had abuse on social media if it was around. They did get some racist abuse, the players. But I think the trouble with social media, I think, is it's very easy to take the reactions of a minority. I mean, it can appear a substantial minority if it's hundreds or even thousands of messages. But of course, that may only be a tiny fraction of the number of people who watched the match. And it's a good example, I think, of the way that social media takes sort of extreme kind of hateful views and amplifies them. So they maybe appear bigger than they were. I mean, striking thing for me was the backlash against it, which I don't think you would have seen actually 20 or 30 years ago, you know, with people kind of embracing the players and sticking up for them and doing murals of them and things like that. I don't think you'd have seen that in 1990. I think you'd have had the racism then, but social media wouldn't have existed to kind of distribute it. Let's move on to the church. Yeah, Tim Vasby Burney. So he asks a brilliant question. Has the Church of England reinforced our sense of next to Europe, not in Europe? The stories of the Reformation, the break with Rome, Continentals who martyred people, the sneaky Spanish, all these used to be known by everyone and could easily have made the English think of ourselves as not the same as others. Now, Tom, I have a very strong view about this. What's your view?
I think it definitely did. I think that Protestantism was an absolutely key component in specifically English national identity. But I also think it's also a key component in British identity, because the fact that the Scots were also Protestant enabled the English and the Scots to come together and feel a kind of commonality against, say, the French that simply hadn't been there in the Middle Ages when Scotland and France were at the old alliance.
I mean, that's Linda Colley's argument in her book, Britons, isn't it? About the invention of Great Britain in the 18th century and Protestantism. An opposition to Catholic Europe being an absolutely central component of that, which I think is very convincing. And I agree with Tim Vasby Burney's question, actually. I think absolute. I mean, I grew up in the 1980s, 70s and 80s, you know, very much that the history textbooks that I read there was a sense that, you know, the break with Rome, great moment in progress,
you know, get away from the Inquisition,
all that kind of thing. Jesuits burning people, isn't this? And of course, you know, we might have had to burn a few Catholics, but that was absolutely reasonable because they were traitors. Yeah. I mean, that's the implication of English Whiggish and indeed British Whiggish history, I would say, from the 18th century, well, not the 18th century, from the 16th century right through to the late 20th.
Well, we in our episode on historical parallels with Brexit, we talked about the degree to which the Reformation might conceivably have informed a particular vision of British independence.
David Starkey, I think, is a great man for arguing this, and always enormously annoys people, particularly Remainers, because they think he's saying it means it's made Brexit inevitable and right because it followed the Reformation. I don't think it made it either inevitable or right necessarily, but I think if you're tracing the roads to Brexit, one of them definitely starts, or one of them has a huge way station in the middle of the 16th century.
Okay, Dominic, here's a very interesting question. Stray Brit. I would posit that the average Brit has more in common culturally with the Swedes and Germans than we have with Aussies, Kiwis, and certainly the Yanks.
So there's a big discussion on the Discord about Britain. And so it wasn't necessarily about Britain. It was about England stroke Britain. Of course, they're two different things. That's a good question, Tom. I would say culturally, no, I don't agree with Stray Brit. I would say there are all kinds of ways in which we have lots in common with the Swedes or the Germans or the Danes or the Dutch. But culturally, so in terms of the culture we regularly consume, I would say we've got much more in common with New Zealanders and Australians simply because we watch a lot of the same television, listen to the same music, have a lot of shared cultural sporting references, for example. Yeah. And of course we do with the Swedes and the Germans, let's say, as well through football. But what do you think?
We don't play the Swedes at cricket.
I suppose
perhaps we should, because then probably we'd win.
I do think we have there's lots of commonalities with Scandinavians, but I think maybe they work. A lot of Scandinavians will have seen British TV, won't they, and know of British things far more than we will know of the affairs of Denmark.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I think Scandinavia is a kind of, it serves lots of people as an inspiration.
It does, doesn't it? But it's an idealized Scandinavia, rather like the idealized France or the idealized Italy. I love the idealized Scandinavia as much as anybody, as somebody who goes on holiday to Scandinavia a lot.
Well, you're a huge enthusiast for Finnish cooking, aren't you?
Like Jacques Chirac.
Yeah. But although Peripatetic Wang, I think, is onto something, in my experience, the English and Dutch are undoubtedly the closest culturally, though there is still a big gulf between us, from attitudes to politeness. And he name checks the two-faced hypocritical Brit to absolute fundamentals like queuing. There are big differences. I think that England specifically and the Netherlands, the Dutch Republic, Holland, whatever you want to call it, I think there are parallels in our history.
Thomas, I'm always telling you we should do a podcast about this.
We are going to. I've got so many ideas for podcasts.
Benjamin
about
mentions
history.
Ireland. And now Ireland is a really interesting one because Ireland, I think the relationship is very one way as somebody who's married to an Irish woman. People in Ireland will often be very well informed about what's going on in Britain and will read British newspapers or at least the Irish editions of British newspapers and watch Irish TV. But in my experience, people in Britain generally know nothing at all about Ireland.
Well, but Benjamin's who you're quoting, I think Ireland's in a weird position where England is closest to Ireland and Ireland itself is closer to America. He's kind of implying the opposite.
I can't see where Benjamin's coming from with that. I mean, a lot of Irish people do look to America. There's no doubt about that. But I'm always immensely struck by going to Cork, which, you know, used to be known as the Rebel City and all this sort of hotbed of the independence movement, and going to the pub and, you know, a Premier League game or indeed a Championship game may well be on the telly and people are discussing the players with as much interest and knowledge as you would find in any English town. And there's a copy of the Irish edition of The Sun or something on the bar. And, you know, I think they're not the same, but the two cultures are deeply enmeshed, but there's a sort of one way sense to it. So it wouldn't work the other way around, if you know what I mean. And I think Ireland and England are both satellites of America to an extent culturally, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely. Andy W., no one mentioned the 2012 Olympics and the opening ceremony. Fantastic representation of modern England, very Blair. I was very impressed with us for not mentioning that.
Modern England or modern Britain?
It was modern England, I guess, he's talking about.
James Bond is a big figure, but James Bond is British rather than English. He's half Scottish,
the Queen,
half
of course.
Swiss.
Parachuting out of the helicopter.
The National Health Service, again, British rather than English. That was a big part of the... J.M. Barrie, was he Scottish?
They had English, Scottish, Northern Irish and Welsh kind of folk dancing or something, didn't they?
Yeah. Isambard Kingdom Brunel played a big part, wasn't it? Played by Kenneth Branagh.
In his splendid hat.
Yeah.
Like Dan Jackson.
Yes, he did look like Dan Jackson. well, I think these are, I mean, England and Britain is a really complicated and actually no amount of podcasts could sort that out.
Well, like I just did with Holland and the Netherlands.
Yeah. But I mean, people who complain about that.
To the people of Maastricht.
Sam, our sort of, who wangles these questions for us, Sam is always moaning at me about saying Holland instead of the Netherlands.
Yeah, well, no, fair enough. French presidents, Tim Fazby Burney again, who's absolutely on fire. The second episode mentions the fact that so many presidents are on the right. The impression I have of France that it is so dominated by the unions and what I consider a very left-wing view of work relations. Am I wrong? What's going on there?
Tim, you've got to stop reading the Daily Telegraph.
And then Al Akfar, I think it's to do with different conceptions of left and right. Anglo-Saxon countries, post-70s, at least tend to think of the right as being economically liberal and their left as being pro-economic regulation. That essentially doesn't seem to align to the left-right axis elsewhere. I think that's true.
Complicated question. I think the French state has been more small-c conservative since the 1970s, so it's been more protectionist. That's meant a kind of implicit alliance with the unions in some ways, or at least they haven't challenged, the state hasn't challenged the unions in the same way that it did in Britain in the 1980s.
Well, we talked, didn't we, about how Marine Le Pen, you know, her economic policy very much appealed to those who might have voted for Mélenchon.
Yeah, the sort of left behinds.
The
left behinds. I think as well, what often happens with France, I think, it goes back to that point we were making earlier, is that people in Britain in particular have a fantasy image of France. And so they're particularly people on the sort of liberal left in Britain, they create this France of the imagination in which everything runs perfectly and, you know, the state is very kind. And
what's that made up Twitter account? Is it R.S. Archer or something?
What's that? I don't know what that is.
He's a wholly made up British author who supposedly lives in France and has delicious food and is always living the life and he's relentlessly rude about Brexit.
So is this a sort of Leavers parody of a Remainers?
No, I think it's a kind of Remainer dream of.
Oh right, yeah. Well, of course, life. I mean, in reality, I think French politics in many ways is much more conservative than British politics, much slower to embrace change, but also much more protective of the idea of France.
Sergeant Musgrave, more seriously, why is French politics so relentlessly, some might say, depressingly male?
There have been, Ségolène
Royal. Do you remember
Royal,
Edith Cresson.
There was a politician called Martine Aubry, who I think was the daughter of Jacques Delors. Anne Hidalgo, who I think was the mayor of Paris, or maybe still is the mayor of Paris.
Well, she crashed and burned, didn't she?
She did.
1.5% or something.
So there have been some prominent French women, but for whatever reason, they haven't broken through.
Edith Cresson was my favourite, because she said all English men were gay.
She did.
And she compared the Japanese to ants.
She did. I can remember that. Yeah. I'd forgotten that. So the French have their own fantasy image of Britain.
And here's a great question from Chet Danbury. Are the French people ever shocked when their presidents turn out to be crooks, philanderers, and ne'er-do-wells, or is it just expected in the sort of person who wants to become president?
I don't see how you could be shocked, could you? I mean... I mean, I think the people who lead the world in being shocked at presidential bad behavior are the Americans, who are constantly astounded and horrified when their presidents...
Well, but they've weaponized it, haven't they?
I mean,
are they really shocked?
Yes.
They use it as a way to take their opponents to court and to impeach them and so
You're
on.
Right. Because they'll sort of say the dignity of the office, the sanctity of the Oval Office that Bill Clinton or whoever has tarnished in this terrible way. And you sort of think, well, how often can it be tarnished before you just accept that it's a grubby hellhole of depravity and disaster.
But moral shock has been weaponized there.
It has, yeah.
Okay, so Jewish Revolt. Christine Snyder, has anyone else found the Crucifixion, Jewish Revolt, and even Babylon episodes deeply moving from a personal spiritual standpoint, situating my faith in a historical era with such intelligence, academic rigor, erudition, etc.? Great choice, Sam, for picking this one. Has been incredibly enriching for my faith. Well,
I think you wrote that yourself, Tom.
I didn't.
I get a lot of commentary. I get a lot of commentary like that about the Jeremy Thorpe episode, actually.
That's interesting, because I think that looking certainly at the Bible and trying to put it in a historical context doesn't always work to the credibility of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
I think particularly the Babylonian stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, basically the Bible gets it all wrong, pretty much.
Yeah, but some people would say, that doesn't necessarily invalidate it, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean,
I think it's not meant to be. It's not a PhD.
No, it's not. But the kind of the details of who, for instance, captures Babylon and stuff. The Book of Daniel gets that very wrong. I suppose it doesn't matter. Well, that's an interesting perspective. And then Richard H., I push back on the view that Pilate is at all made more bland, palatable for non-Jews. On the contrary, he's shown to be completely ruthless and cynical in his actions. His overriding task as governor was to maintain peace and quiet. Tom is right about his general approach of divide and rule, but in the gospel accounts, he is contemptuous of the Jewish establishment and of Jesus.
So my view about Pilate, Tom, very similar to my view of Richard III. He did it.
He did it, and he was right to do it.
The stability of the realm is all that matters.
Well, it's funny you should say, because basically that is what the Gospels say.
Right.
So the Gospels never deny that Jesus was sentenced by Pilate. They never deny that he was crucified by Roman soldiers. I think they do slightly spin it to make it seem that he is reluctant. Mm-hmm. And there's no question that in the centuries that follow, there are Christians who do argue that it was the Jews who crucified Jesus. So Lactantius, for instance, who is a Christian advisor to Constantine, he explicitly says that Jesus was handed over by Pilate to the Judeans, which is not what the Gospels say at all. But there is there's a very good, interesting book by a theologian called David Lloyd Doosanbury, which came out, I think, a couple of years ago, called The Innocence of Pontius Pilate. And he traces the course, the evolution of this whole idea of Pilate's relationship to Jesus's trial. And he points out that there are gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament. So there's the Gospel of Peter that blames Herod Agrippa for it, says Herod Agrippa did it. In the Talmud, there are accounts of Jesus dies by being hanged or stoned that makes it a kind of, the Romans don't come into it. It's right. an intra-Jewish bust up about kind of allegations of sorcery. Jesus is condemned for sorcery. But Doosanbury has at his core, friend of the show, St. Augustine, who we mentioned at the start of this episode, that Augustine says that Pilate's judgment following you, that he did it and he was right to do it because Jesus was guilty under Roman terms, but Jesus's kingdom was not of this earth. And Doosanbury's argument is that this is a bit like Jesus saying, render unto Caesar and render unto God, because he is positing there what Dominic, as you will know, I see as being fundamental to modern Western civilization, this divide between concepts of the secular and the religious, that the origins of that can be traced all the way back to Pilate's role in Jesus's trial.
Okay. Tom, you've turned that very, very deftly to your thesis, I thought.
Well, it's Doosanbury's thesis as well.
Yeah. Okay. I'm persuaded. He did it and he was right to do it. So, Tom, we should pack up because we've got to go and do another. We've got to go and record another podcast.
Yep. We're recording an episode on the history of childbirth in literally a minute. So we must go and do that.
Okay. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.